Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes the Mustang such a powerful symbol of the American spirit? Horses have been a part of the culture of this country since Hernan Cortes brought 16 of them on his New World conquest 500 years ago. By the early 20th century, feral descendants of those horses and others imported by Europeans had spread out across the continent and numbered around 2 million. Just a century later, though, their numbers have dwindled alarmingly. About 25,000 roam unfettered on federal land, while about 30,000 live in holding areas. And despite the vigilance of passionate advocates for Mustang welfare, much of the landmark 1971 legislation designed to protect wild horses was rolled back in 2005. So what is to become of America's wild horses, and what makes these powerful animals so vulnerable in modern times? Author Deanne Stillman explains it in her new book, Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. Deanne, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks a lot, Chris. I really appreciate your having me on your show.
Well, we should start by saying this is so interesting to me that we think of the Spaniards sort of importing these horses, but in fact, this is their second time to run wild in North America. Can you talk a little bit about the fossil record and what it's shown us about the equine evolution?
Oh, sure. I'm really glad you asked that question because it really goes to the heart of the whole issue of whether or not wild horses deserve a place here on the range. And as I learned during my years of research into my book, horses originated on this continent, you know, in America, and they are, in fact, North America's gift to the world. The first horse appeared here 55 million years ago and was the size of a fox terrier, which is kind of hard to imagine. And over the millennia, of course, it evolved and got bigger and faster and became the big-hearted fleet athlete of the plains that we know and admire today. It during the Ice Age, it was traveling across the Bering Land Bridge and populating the rest of the world, and meanwhile had gone extinct here. Now, the fossil record shows there are countless horse fossils across the American West from all of these different stages of its evolution. You would use the word feral earlier in your description of wild horses, but in fact, mitochondrial DNA links the horses that returned to this continent with Cortez to the Ice Age horses that originally evolved here.
Wow!
And they're really not feral at all. They are, in fact, what scientists refer to as native reintroduced wildlife. And as I say, there are countless fossils across the American West. And I myself went to an amazing place in Death Valley known as the Barnyard, which is a rock panel in which hundreds of horse tracks are frozen in time, tracks from the Miocene period 14 million years ago. And that kind of became my inspiration in writing my book, one of the inspirations, because I always, as I was writing, I kind of envisioned myself following those tracks across time.
So I guess they traveled in herds then as they do today. Can you talk about the sort of social structure that wild horses have?
Well, they have an amazingly tight-knit family bond, you know, the way a lot of other animal populations do. There's a lead mare, you know, in the popular imagination, we often think of, like, the great wild stallion leading the herds, but in fact, the stallions when they travel, the stallion is at the back of the herd watching, and it's the lead mare that blazes the trail, and the rest of the horses follow, and they live in bands inside the herd, and as I said, they're very, very tightly knit family units, so that nowadays and whenever, you know, in the history of roundups, whenever there have been these roundups, one of the disturbing things is that these family units are broken up, and it's very difficult for the horses to live through you know, that sort of disruption and remain intact.
What are the first reports of wild horses in the American West after they had sort of broken free or been set free? How long did it take for them to start populating in large numbers?
Well, they when they returned to the New World with Cortez in 1519, and there were 16 horses on his voyage, and that's the first chapter in my book, The Horses Return, and I recount the story of their march into the jungle and went back into the old archives and found out the names of each of the 16 horses. And
it's remarkable to think the relationships that they had even then, that they thought that was very important.
Pardon me, I didn't quite hear what you said.
Oh, well, it's remarkable that even in Cortez's time, they were so bonded to these animals that they gave them names and they were, you know, important enough to record all that information.
Oh, I know. Well, there was an amazing scribe, the official scribe of the Cortez expedition, obviously was a great lover of horses himself, because you can tell from his chronicles in the way he described the horses and made a point of talking about their personalities and so on, that it was important to him, and as you say, you know, everyone else on that expedition. And when it was all over, when the Aztecs had been conquered, about 20 years later, Cortez said, "We owe it all to God and the horse." So he you know, one of the very few soldiers or you know, cavaliers down through the ages who actually has given credit to the horse. But you were saying that you were asking about their proliferation in the American West, and they did. The survivors of the conquistador expeditions set up shop very quickly on their native turf. Some of them escaped from, you know, these various cavalry marches through the jungles of Mexico and ran towards El Norte, their home. Others were bred at the first horse breeding ranches in the New World, which, interestingly enough, many of those ranches were run by crypto Jews who were fleeing the Spanish Inquisition and were, you know, very closely connected with reintroducing the horse to the, you know, to our continent. Once the horses were heading across the Rio Grande into Texas and the Southwest, they began proliferating really quickly, and of course moved into the tribes and you know, altered Native American culture permanently and quickly.
You have actually seen wild horses sort of moving about unfettered in the wild. Can you talk about what that experience is like?
Wow, it's truly breathtaking. You know, wild horses are in our bones, and you know, they course through our blood as Americans. But it's one thing to say that, but seeing that is entirely different. I grew up around horses. My mother was one of the first women in the country to ride professionally on the racetrack as what used to be called an exercise boy. And I myself learned to ride when I was a kid, and you know, was always thrilled about being around horses and just, you know, quite taken when I would watch them run, and as a kid imagine myself racing across the plains with Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and Calamity Jane, and just, you know, that sight of manes and tails flying in the wind was just so much a part of my upbringing. But as I said, seeing it for real in the West is something else. The first time I saw wild horses running wild, being Mustangs, was in Nevada, outside Reno, actually, in the Virginia Range. This was 10 years ago. I had learned that 34 wild horses had been gunned down outside Reno at Christmas time, and I was finishing up my previous book, 29 Palms, about two girls who had been killed by a Marine after the Gulf War, and I had heard this terrible story, and ultimately what happened was there had been an arrest, and two of the men were Marines, and one of them was stationed at 29 Palms. So that kind of drew me into the story, and plus my own upbringing with horses. And I went to Reno and began looking into this whole incident. And so that's, as I say, that's where I saw, you know, I went up into the Virginia Range with some guides, and that's where I saw wild horses for the first time. And this sounds like a cliche, and I suppose it is one, and often cliches are true, but the sight of them running wild truly took my breath away, and I realized at that moment that watching wild horses running across open space is an American birthright. I mean, they are our great icon of freedom. They blazed our trails and they fought our wars, and that all just hit me at once when the first time I saw them. I was just truly stunned, and I really feel that as Americans, we have the right to see them on their home turf, and more importantly, they have a right to live there.
Deanne Stillman is my guest. Her new book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. Well, let's talk, Deanne, about why there are some people who don't think that they should be roaming free on federal lands. For one thing, there are ranchers who have cattle on the same lands who say, well, there's too much competition for resources and there's only so much grazing land to go around.
Well, let's just take a look at the numbers for a moment. On public lands where wild horses are mandated by law to range, there are at most maybe 23,000 wild horses left today, down from 2 million at the beginning of the 20th century. More than half of those live in Nevada, and the others in the western states. The reason more wild horses are in Nevada today is because they went there to hide, like a lot of people do. You know, the state has a lot of hideouts, and they went there to be left alone, although it's, you know, really, you know, civilization goes everywhere today, and horses are under siege there and elsewhere. There are over 3 million cattle on public lands, on the same public lands where wild horses live. So you have a, you know, ratio of 3 million to, say, 23,000. I think there's I don't really quite understand what the problem is. The livestock industry has been trying to purge Mustangs from public lands for decades. I document this ongoing war against wild horses in my book, and it goes back for many, many years. Many cattlemen view Mustangs as animals that steal food from cows, and they, in fact, refer to them as thieves. It's kind of peculiar to me because, you know, without no horse, no America, for one thing, no horse, no Texas, no horse, no cattle industry. So something I explore in my book, the big question my book asks is, why are we, a cowboy nation, destroying the horse we rode in on? I mean, surely there's enough room on the range for the remaining 23,000 wild horses, but those are under siege, and in fact, right now there are more horses in government holding, 30,000, than there are on the range, and now there's talk of euthanizing those 30,000 in government custody because presumably it costs too much to maintain them. So we're at a real critical moment here for our, you know, great icon and partner. And as I travel around the country and you know, discuss this, and I'll be at the Clements Center this Thursday talking about my book at SMU, I've found that many Americans across the board, pretty much everyone who shows up at my readings is in favor of wild horse preservation, and I'm not just talking about, you know, people who might be disparaged as tree huggers. I'm also talking about people who chop down trees.
Deanne Stillman is my guest. She will be at that event she mentioned at the Clements Center at SMU. That's taking place at 6 o'clock on Thursday, November 13th. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. The book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. If you want to join us, you can get on the line now. We'll take your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Deanne Stillman. Her book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. She will be appearing on Thursday at 6 at the Clements Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. You can find information about that book signing event on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org. You were talking, Deanne, about the horses that are in captivity in federal custody. And I know there have been efforts to get those animals adopted as opposed to euthanizing them or doing anything else. How have those programs worked?
Well, the adoption program, let me backtrack for a second. According to the 1971 law protecting wild horses and burros, management of those populations has fallen mostly to the Bureau of Land Management inside the Department of the Interior, and they are charged with controlling the herds because most of the horses' natural predators are gone from their, roaming areas. To control the herds, they carry out periodic roundups, and in the past, for many years, those roundups have been based often enough on outdated studies or pressure from the livestock industry. What happens to the horses that are rounded up, and the burros too, is that they're channeled into the Bureau of Land Management's Adopt-a-Horse and Burro program. Right now there are just far too many horses in government custody, as we mentioned, 30,000, and far too few adopters, partly because of the collapsing economy. You know, it's expensive to keep a horse, and, you know, people just can't afford to take on that kind of endeavor right now. The adoption program has been plagued by other problems as well. For instance, I document this in my book, in Nevada a few years ago, there were 6 or 7 horses in a government corral, and a BLM employee went home for a few days and apparently forgot to turn on the spigot, and the horses died of thirst. Now, that's, of course, on its face, very disturbing, but what makes it even worse is that one of the reasons one of the things that BLM uses to round up horses is drought, and that's really kind of an excuse for roundups. But here we have a situation where horses are in captivity and not given water, and those particular 6 horses had evidently been rounded up because of the drought situation. And another thing that happens with the drought excuse is that horses taken from the range because of an apparent lack of water are never returned after being given a drink. And there are no other wild animals that are removed from the range because of a drought. So it's kind of disingenuous for the government to use drought or lack of food as an excuse to take horses off the range. And you know, that kind of thing has contributed to the fact that there are 30,000 horses right now in the Adopt-a-Horse program, and there shouldn't be that many horses in government custody in the first place.
So, is there sort of management that could work to protect them when there are drought conditions without removing them? I was a reporter years ago along the Texas and New Mexico border, mm-hmm. and there were a bunch of wild horses that died, and I can't remember the exact number because there had been a drought. I don't know if they had access to water, but there certainly wasn't much to eat, and so there were several found starved to death. I know your concern is that if they're brought out of the wild, then they won't be returned. Is there a way to efficiently move them to an area where there might be better access to land where they could find food and water?
Well, I mean, that's a good question and a complicated one. I mean, you know, there are so many things that contribute to the deteriorating range at the moment, including global warming and competition for forage, and not just among cattle and sheep, and the dwindling wild horse populations. I'm not so sure that horses or any animal should be moved to an area where there are, where there is more food and water. I mean, these are wild animals. You know, if the government is worried about lack of water, then why not just let the horses fend for themselves and die off, if that's what happens among other animal populations. And I don't mean that to sound crass, but that's life in the wild. I mean, it's peculiar that horses are given, singled out for special treatment. You know, let's give them a drink. It's terrible. Yes, it's terrible, but let's not punish the horses, which is ultimately what happens when they're taken off the range because they can't find food or water. And the 1971 law protecting them says that they are to be considered in the place where they were found at the time that law went into effect. And there's no reason to remove them from their home ranges other than, you know, as I said, pressure from the livestock industry and now increased gas and oil drilling. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be any management at all. Clearly, there does need to be some, you know, culling of the herds from time to time. But these cullings need to be based on up-to-date science, which they are not. And, in fact, a couple of BLM scientists resigned about 3 years ago because they said they were pressured by the Bush administration to alter the findings of a grazing study to favor the livestock lobby. And as I say in my book, this kind of thing, this sort of pressure from the livestock industry to get horses off of our public lands dates back for generations, in fact, to the time of the Teddy Roosevelt administration. And even Roosevelt himself talked about it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is author Deanne Stillman. Her new book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. Let's go to Peter in Lucas. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. Ms. Stillman, thank you for bringing attention to the Mustang situation. It is a complicated one, and that's an understatement, as you well know. I have, for the last probably 7 or 8 years, I have been involved in Wyoming, working with a particular herd there in the Great Basin there, and you've probably been out there in the Rock Springs area there. And I have to say, and I didn't have, you know, I'm an artist, and my original intent was just going out there and photographing and painting wild horses, and so I have a little different bent, and I didn't have an agenda when I went out there, and I must say that I have, and I'm in the cattle business in a small way myself, and have country here in Texas and in Oklahoma. But I was very impressed with, you know, as you have well stated, it's a very complicated thing for this bureaucracy to work with the wild horse dealers. A lot of forces against them, but the BLM, in my experience, especially, and I guess I'm only familiar with the Wyoming and the adopting areas in Oklahoma and so forth, but they have tried really hard to do a good job with the resources that they've had. It's not a perfect deal, but, you know, I think, you know, so many of the areas where these horses live, it may be 2 to 3 sections of land per cow-calf unit that people are allowed to graze on there for their federal, which is section of land is 640 acres, so in some of these areas in Nevada, there is no grass, and there is certainly hardly any water. So when people talk about competition for grass and water, there is a tremendous competition, and I think that, not that that should take away from the horse's plight, but it is a complicated deal, and I'd like you to. And one of the other things that I think that people can do is they can go up if they ever have an opportunity to go to Oklahoma. If here in Texas, there's a great adoption center, and the Mustang, the BLM has done what's called the Mustang adoption or a Mustang makeover, and they're really doing a good job as far as bringing attention to what can be done with these horses. Typically, they are not pets; but they can make great horses if you are a savvy horse person. And so I hope that more attention is given to what is being done in the positive areas and not, you know, just the fact that it's a bureaucratic nightmare, which it has been,
Peter,
and very underfunded.
Lots of great points. I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Do you want to respond to any of that, Dean?
Yes, Peter, you do make some great points, and I completely agree with you. And as I said earlier, it's a hugely complicated situation, and I know that the BLM is kind of a beleaguered agency in terms of its wild horse and burro management situation, because it's a multiple use management agency and it has to juggle a whole lot of things. And some people think that maybe wild horses shouldn't even be under its mandate, because, you know, the question is the Mustang a natural resource? That's what the BLM does. It manages natural resources. Or is it, you know, is it really a wild animal, which I happen to think it is, and that's what the law says it is, and maybe it should be managed by another agency. But that's another radio show, actually. And I know that the BLM, you know, in many of its branches and outposts, it has a lot of good people, and they really, really do a wonderful job in terms of helping the horses, you know, move through channels and into good homes. And I've met people who've adopted wild horses and have, and they're fantastic, you know, parents to the horses that they've taken in, and it's quite inspiring. And I know that the U.S. The U.S. Marine Mounted Color Guard uses only Palomino Mustangs from Nevada in its ceremonies, and that's quite a spectacular. Their ceremonies are quite spectacular, and I've spoken to people in law enforcement around the country who, you know, use only Mustangs in their patrol units, and I think all of this is a great thing. But there is, as you mentioned, Peter, there is some reluctance, or as you were hinting at, on the part of a lot of people to adopt Mustangs, possibly because they don't really believe that Mustangs, you know, are trainable, or, you know, are, can be used for very, you know, all of these purposes, as I was mentioning, law enforcement, and they're good workhorses. Some people use them in dressage. I mean, or some people just want to have them and let them continue to do what they do in the wild, which is just, you know, be themselves and run free. But I totally encourage people to take them in, but really only if they're able to, if they take a hard look at their own financial circumstances and understand that a horse is a big commitment, and that's not something you can return to the store, you know, a few months later because you're tired of it.
Do they have to be gentled by a certain age if they've been wild in order to for that training to really take effect, or is there evidence that they can be several years old and still be gentled?
No, they're. I mean, I've met horses that have been adopted at, you know, various ages and have been gentled, you know, at these different points in their lives. I think it's probably harder, you know, down the line, but not necessarily. I mean, I think it really, that depends a lot on who's involved, the people who are involved, and also the history of the horse. Some horses, you know, have not had a good time when they after they've been captured, and are, you know, it might take longer to gentle them. But I think it really depends on the people involved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Deanne Stillman, whose new book is called Mustang. Let's go next to Sharon in Granbury. Hello, Sharon.
Hi. I just had a real quick question. I understand that funding is a key issue here, and I'm just wondering what sources would you propose for funding? We're obviously pretty strapped economically as a nation, and if there are some perhaps private efforts that could be a little better organized at getting funding where it needs to go. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, it certainly nowadays, in terms of what's going on in the country economically, it's a good question. My understanding is that the annual federal budget for wild horse and burro management is $39 million. Now, that's really a drop in the bucket when you look at federal budgets. And as I travel around the country, one of the things I have asked people is, would you either be willing to Would you like to have a checkbox on the IRS form which says, you know, I contribute $1, you know, out of my taxes every year to preserve wild horses and burros?
Either the presidential election or wild horses.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. I guarantee you more people would be involved in wild horses, although perhaps not this time, this election, but I can tell you from what goes on in my events that they're, you know, generally unanimous support for wild horse preservation. And as I said earlier, I'm talking about people across the board on all sides of other issues. This is one area where everybody unites and agrees, and it's quite a thing to behold. Another thing I ask is, would you just be willing to send a buck to the BLM to say, you know, save wild horses? And I'm not suggesting people do that, because who knows who would, you know, what would happen to the mail. And also, there's evidently some postal service layoffs coming up, so the mail might never get there. But, and by the way, that's not to slam the U.S. Postal Service, which I think does a great job. And it all started with the Pony Express. I'm not so sure that there really is that big of a problem with in terms of continuing to generate the $39 million. This annual budget, it's not that big of a budget, although I know everyone's looking for cuts to make these days. That I don't think people will stand for the eradication of our wild horse populations, and I know I won't, and that's why I wrote my book.
The book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. We'll be back in just a minute with Deanne Stillman. You can meet her at an event she is going to be signing books on Thursday, November 13th at 6 at the Clemens Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. More information about that is available on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Deanne Stillman. Her new book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. She will be in town on Thursday, November 13th for a book signing event at SMU that takes place at the Clement Center for Southwest Studies. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org. Deanne, I have to tell you, we do a fair amount of American history on this program. It is very rare that I have a guest who comes on and calls Richard Nixon a hero.
Listen, I was shocked to find this out myself.
It's good to have a redeeming quality.
Yeah. Well, the 1971 law, the Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Protection Act, was signed by Richard Nixon himself after an amazing Nevada character named Wild Horse Annie spent 20 years lobbying for the first and only federal protection for wild horses and burros, and she did so at great risk to herself, and it was just one of those epic American battles that involved, at first just a few people, and she was banging out letters on her old portable Royal typewriter in her office where she worked as a secretary in Reno, and she, you know, galvanized and people around the world ultimately, and finally this hard fought battle that she waged, you know, was successful, and Nixon made a stirring and impassioned speech on behalf of wild horses at the Rose Garden ceremony where he signed the bill, and I document the speech in my book, and Wild Horse Annie's entire, decades-long struggle. And Nixon quoted Thoreau as he signed the bill. There are so many surprises in my book, really, and this is one.
Yeah, elegant, compassionate.
This is one of the big ones. Mm-hmm. And you think of people, we often talk about our great cowboy presidents. Ronald Reagan, who was an equestrian, no friend to the wild horse. U.S. Grant, who was a great equestrian and was a kind of a horse whisperer of his time and was a tremendous advocate for horses and even evidently would dress down soldiers under his command in the Civil War who were abusing their horses. And one of the last things he talked about on his deathbed evidently were his own horses who lived, near him at the White House. But as I said, it's hard, we don't generally think of Richard Nixon as, a cowboy president. But here he was, defending our great partner. And it's been under the Bush administration that, the false cowboy from Pitt, Texas, that these protections have been unraveled. And I just want to make a point about Texas before I forget. Texas once had a place called the Great Horse Desert, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, and there were millions of horses that lived there. This is an area just north of the Rio Grande, and during the 19th century, countless horses were taken from that area and pressed into cavalry service for the Indian Wars. And I tell the story in my book of a horse named Comanche, the lone survivor, so-called, of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And Comanche was taken from that part of Texas and ended up being wounded in 7 or 8 battles before finally ending up on the battlefield at the Little Bighorn and ultimately surviving it. And when the army came onto the field a couple of days after the battle was over and they found Custer and all of his men killed and his unit surrounded by a breastworks of horses who they had shot for protection out of this carnage stumbled the great war horse Comanche, who was again wounded and had been hit like 9 or 10 times with bullets. And there was talk of putting him down, but somebody intervened and said, no, this horse has a will to live. And somebody else poured some whiskey into a hat and offered it to him, and he took a big swig, and apparently from that point on became something of an alcoholic. At any rate, he was taken back to a nearby steamer and which carried him up the Yellowstone River to a fort where he was retired with full honors and became a celebrity of his era and billed as the great silent witness because of all the things he had seen during the Indian Wars. My point is, here is a great war horse from the the horse desert of Texas. And today is Veterans Day, as I'm thinking about this. It's important to remember that we have, these amazing equine war veterans as well, and it's their descendants that are living on the range today.
You have a lot of really interesting pieces of art in the book, but one that I found the most interesting happened after Little Bighorn. I guess the Army asked Chief Red Horse to put together some kind of illustration of what had happened, and what he chose to draw were all these horses that had been killed.
Oh, I know. I'm so glad you mentioned that pictograph. And thanks for paying attention to the artwork in my book, because I think it's really an important component of it. They asked him to draw, to give his account of what happened at the Little Bighorn. And one of the things he drew was this very harrowing picture of horses with red holes, to depict the bullet wounds. And it's just it's at the Smithsonian Archives, and I, as you say, reprinted in my book. It's just in terms of one picture tells it all. It it tells you exactly what happened at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. As I say in my book, more horses than soldiers died there. And I went back into the old muster rolls, the cavalry muster rolls, and found out the names of a lot of the horses that went down there and exactly what happened to them. And I talk about how the cavalry on that day really became kind of a cavalry, and the horses really were martyred. The story of their service in that battle and all the battles of that area is quite amazing, really amazing. Another thing I did to piece together the story of that battle is go through Native American counts and there are 6,000 books written about Custer, and now I think my book might make it 6,001, but I read quite a few of them, and I compared and contrasted the accounts, looking for stories about what happened to the horses. And one of the things that one of the Native American accounts said is that by the time the cavalry horses had reached the battlefield, some of them were so tired from days on the march and having run out of food that they stopped in the middle of the battle and were grazing. Gives you an idea of how difficult those wars were for the horses.
We have an email from Laura who says she's a junior at SMU and a member of the university's equestrian team. For those who may be unable to adopt, is there any way to volunteer in support of the efforts to save these horses?
Oh, yes, there are. You know, in the last section of my book, I talk about the various sanctuaries around the country who take in these horses, and they all have different approaches. And you can, I also mentioned some of them on my website. You can contact them and volunteer. There might be some in your area. Or you can, of course, contribute money. At this time, all, nonprofits involved in pretty much you name it are all strapped and, could use your donations. You can simply, write letters to your representatives and let them know that you're, you're fully in favor of wild horse preservation and you don't want this euthanasia plan to proceed. As I say, the various ways to get involved, and if you go to deannestillman.com, I talk about some of them, some of these organizations.
One of the changes in the law 3 years ago that has been most devastating was that under certain conditions now, the government is allowed to sell wild horses that it has within its care for slaughter. What justifications have to exist for that to happen?
Horses have to be either over 10 or not adopted on the third try, and at that point they can be sold to the lowest bidder. There was such a public outcry after that passed, the so-called Burns rider, named after former Montana Senator Conrad Burns, who attached that to an appropriations bill a few years ago. There's such an outcry after that due to a huge grassroots effort, the country's three remaining horse slaughter plants were closed down, including one in Texas. There were three foreign-owned plants. So it's really illegal now to send horse. There are no more horse rendering plants in the U.S. They can be shipped across the border to Texas or Mexico, but
from Texas to Mexico.
They can be shipped across the border. Into Mexico,
right.
And Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's no more horse meat production in this country anymore.
Not in this country, but the horses are being shipped out of the country. And there was another bill to stop that, but I believe it's under Larry Craig in Idaho, who has a hold on that bill at this moment. I have testimony in my book of from a former slaughter plant worker, and it's quite. I really urge people to read it and understand what goes on at these plants.
So, Deanne, what is the best that we can hope for, work for, in terms of responsible management of these horses that do live on federal land?
Well, I really think that if the government would just follow the law as it's written, that would be the best to hope for. And what's going on right now is the law isn't being followed. And I've asked in various op-eds and so on and for a temporary moratorium on all roundups until the all studies on all wild horse ranges are brought up to date. I mean, I really think that's the first thing that needs to happen. And before we run out of time, I want to say something, add something to Peter's question earlier. I'm talking about small ranching operations in my book or now in terms of people who would like to see Mustangs taken off of public lands. I'm really referring to these large, often foreign-owned corporate conglomerates that have taken over our public lands in a lot of ways.
You mentioned that you want studies to be completed before we take additional action. And in fact, there was one that was begun earlier this year. Has it concluded anything with regard to the way that horses should be managed and their impact on the landscape?
Are you referring to the GAO report?
Yeah, exactly.
Which the Government Accounting Office just published its a report of an investigation that it waged into whether or not BLM's wild horse and burro management policies are cost-effective, and it has unfortunately come out in favor of this euthanization plan, which was floated a while ago, which is very, very disturbing. You know, Mrs. T. Boone Pickens, of course a well-known Texas resident, has come forward and is trying to work out some arrangement whereby she purchases a large parcel of land and in order to save these 30,000 wild horses that are now imperiled.
Where can people go to see wild horses for themselves?
Well, they can go any number of places, although it's not easy to spot them because, of course, they're wild and kind of shy, actually, and they're out there being free for the rest of us. But you can go to Montana, where the Pryor Mountain Herd outside Billings is kind of accessible. There are only about a little over 100 left there, but they're a famous herd, direct descendants of conquistador horses with a dorsal stripe down their backs. You can go to the BLM Wild Horse and Burro website and find out about all the other herd areas in the country. Some of them are really remote and not accessible at all. Texas has no wild horses left whatsoever, which is really kind of sad considering it, you know, runs on Mustang Mojo. But the other western states do have them.
Deanne Stillman's new book is called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. She'll be appearing Thursday, November 13th at 6 at the Clement Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. Deanne, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Chris. It was great speaking with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.